I'm going to share this talk is really early. When I mean early, this is a project, this is a book project that I'm working on this year. I wrote this book about American Orthodox Judaism, and now I feel that there's a real lacuna. There's nothing that's been written in the last 30 years that compares almost American Judaism and Israeli Judaism, and certainly, a little bit on that, but certainly American Orthodoxy and Israeli Orthodoxy, there's almost nothing that exists. And I suppose because I live in Israel and I'm part of that society and I've studied American or North American Jewry extensively, that maybe hopefully puts me in a good place for doing that kind of comparative work. I call it being an insider-outsider wherever I am, okay? So when I'm in America, I'm the Israeli. When I'm in Israel, I'm the American. And so hopefully I can sort of stand back but also stand inside. So what I'm sharing with you now is some of my initial thoughts as I go into this project. A little bit of it has been written, but I'm going to be really focusing on this, and I'd be very happy and appreciative, and I'm glad this is being taped, if people have suggestions or directions or thoughts on this. There are plenty of people here who spend time in both places and probably have their own observations. It's possible that what I find myself when I go to lectures and when I read things, I might have intuitively thought something, but I didn't really organize my thoughts. But when I hear a lecture, it gets me to start thinking about it. So I'm going to sort of hopefully use you in that way. So here's where it goes. The paradigm, and my teacher, Charles Liebman, and a few other people wrote stuff in the 70s, sort of comparatively between American and Israeli Orthodoxy. The paradigm is there are two different realms. Clearly, when it comes to halakha, when it comes to the sources, the traditions, there's a basis for similarity. But in terms of the way religion runs, it's so different. And I'm just going to list for you the areas in which this manifests itself, the distinctions between what it means to, you know, Orthodox Jewish life in Israel as opposed to North America, being an Orthodox Jew in Israel as opposed to being an Orthodox Jew in the United States. Again, you should know most of these things, but we're going to try to set it up in typologically or at least categorically. So we start, of course, with the fact that the difference between living in a sovereign Jewish state, be it not an Orthodox one, but certainly one in which Orthodox Judaism is the normative Judaism, but a sovereign Jewish state, as opposed to living in a Christian state. A Christian state, if you take, let's say, the Anglo world, each one has a different role for the church. But let's take America, which is the most adamant about division between religion and state. America is clearly a Christian state in terms of majority, in terms of the expectation of who the leaders will be, for the most part, except for exceptions, usually Protestant, in terms of the sense of, you know, what's the normative religion. So religion and state, what it really means is a separation between religion and state means that the state can't give funds to religion. But there is a normative religion. In Canada, as I know, it's a little different in terms of how funding goes for day schools, for different types of parochial activities. Nonetheless, quite a bit of this applies. Certainly Canada is not a Jewish state. It's very much a Christian state. We move further, and it's not just that, let's say, if we take the United States, there's a separation between religion and state. In Israel, there is no separation between religion and state. Religion is funded by the state. There's a chief rabbinate. There are local rabbis. There is a religious court, which is a government agency. The chaplaincy in the army is a Jewish chaplaincy. The public holidays are the Jewish holidays. According to Orthodox tradition, when it comes to personal status, Orthodox religion defines weddings, defines divorces, defines whether someone will be an agunah, defines adoption, defines, of course, as I spoke in Or Haim yesterday, approach to burial. What, for example,
sorry, I have to interrupt. There's a car blocking somebody getting on their park illegally. BYFK 808. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I feel at home now. Israelis always do that. Yeah. Thank God. Baruch Hashem and Iva Bait. Okay. You know, in the middle of a wedding ceremony. Yeah. Okay. So, I lost my train of thought. Now, in Israel, the government pays for burial only if it's a body and if the Chevra Kadisha is. Maybe a non-Orthodox Chevra Kadisha. It has to go through the Ministry of Religion channels. So different than here. Here, religion is choice. There is nothing in the world, certainly in North America, that you have to do based on your religion. In the United States, in Canada, I know it's listed. They do allow it to be listed on when they have population surveys. But am I correct that in Canada there is no coercion of religion in any way, shape, or form, and certainly not Jewish coercion? It's purely choice. Language, of course, language. The language here it's English, French in Quebec, Hebrew. Gershom Scholem wrote very pointedly about insightfully about how when you have cities called Mevaser Tzion, and when the capital is Yerushalayim, and when Shivat Tzion, and streets and Chovavei Tzion and Geula, that even on a sort of a subliminal level, the sort of redemptive historic sense of what this all means, it can't be completely escaped even by people who are very distant from those things. None of this really is relevant to Jewish life here, except one place, which I found really fascinating. I don't know if this is the case in Canada. I remember when my grandmother passed away at 101, and I went to she was buried in the Chelka of the Young Israel Borough Park somewhere in Queens, in that very large cemetery, the longitudinal streets are names of presidents, like Lincoln Street, sort of like Yerushalayim, right? Lincoln, right? Lincoln Street, Washington Street, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Jefferson. And then the cross streets, right, are Machpelah, Beit Lechem, Tzion. I thought that was great, you know, American Jewry, you know, in their little private place. Okay. Compartmentalization, I think that's a very, very important one. Of course, today, post-67, and today you see much more visual Judaism outside, certainly if you live in certain places, if you drive in this area of Bathurst, you know, the kosher stores, the writing. And I was in Riverdale, where I grew up, last week, and my barber, who I've been going to, I went to since I was a kid, who I went back to, it says Mispara in his window, you know. But other than those places, you know, the language is English, and Hebrew is not really relevant to anything that goes on. In Israel, the language of the Sidur, the language of the Chumash, the language of the Tanakh is the lingua franca, and the most secular Israeli can read Chumash if with a little bit of work, better than a kid who's gone to day school here for whatever years. I mean, a little bit of work just to get the syntax, etc. But Hebrew, I believe this strongly, Hebrew is the key to almost everything in Judaism, if from a skill set perspective. If you have Hebrew, many of us grew up in an Ivrit generation, and that's not the case now, because the sense of, if I teach in Hebrew, I won't be able to teach as much Gemara. I won't be able to teach the Ramban and the Rashi the same way. And to me, it seems like once the person has the real skills in the Hebrew, they'll get the other thing. And I think it was a wrong educational turn, but there are reasons for that. So Judaism is very compartmentalized in the home, in the synagogue, when you go to camp, when you're in maybe certain neighborhoods. And in Israel, it's all over. It's all over. Some places more intensive, some less. Some, you know, Jerusalem is different than Tel Aviv, but even in Tel Aviv or even in Kfar Saba where I live, it's very much the Jewishness and religious Judaism. Shalom Aviad. Aviad is a very, very dear friend of my son. They were roommates in Yeshivat Har Tzion together, and he's a good friend of mine too. Rabbi Pitukaycha. Then you get to sort of pragmatic, well, you know, we'll do one more sort of classic religious thing, which is how religion works. And Israel is, I already alluded to, it's an Orthodox Judaism. There is a burgeoning conservative movement. There is a burgeoning reform movement. They will always be boutique-y, and they will always serve certain audiences, and maybe they'll even be strong enough to give some competition to the Orthodox so that the Orthodox will be a little bit more flexible and will realize that they can't just, you know, run, you know, rough. How's that going? You know, on everybody. And I think that would be a good thing, actually, because I think when you have a monopoly, it's just not healthy. You know, its absolute power is corruptive for any area. So, but in North America, you have choices, denominations. I mean, I have a student, a lovely, wonderful student who's doing great work here in Toronto, Rabbi Adam Cutler. Do you know him? He's the rabbi, the younger rabbi in Beth Tzedek. He was my student in Bar-Ilan 16 years ago. Daniel Held, who's now the head of the Board of Jewish Education, was also my student. Great kids. I mean, they're not kids anymore, but I remember they used to come for Shabbos and stayed in touch with them all the years. You know, you don't have shuls like Beth Tzedek in Israel. Even the Orthodox shuls aren't synagogue communities in the same way, but because Judaism is all over. But the choices. You have many denominations, you have many ideology, you have many approaches. Of course, you have Haredim, and you have religious Zionists, and you have Yeshuvim, and you have cities, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all within the rubric of orthodoxy. Here, you have compartmentalized Judaism, but you also have multiple options for where you locate yourself ideologically, how you choose your rabbi or rabbinic leader, where you educate your children, et cetera. And I can tell you I have some Haredi relatives who learned in Kollel in Israel, and when their kids got to day school age, they went to America, they moved to Muncie, because they said that they felt that there were more educational options for them. Because they were like Haredi, but not like, you know, like sort of modern Haredi, and they felt that they didn't have that zan, that exact way in where they were living in Ramat Eshkol in Yerushalayim, which was kind of interesting. So for all those reasons, and maybe you can add some more, it's clear that there are distinctions, and we can add some more, of course, between Orthodox Jewish life. Oh, and I didn't mention this, it's not just for Orthodoxy, but it's very important. Army. What does a kid do at 18 in Israel, and what does a kid do at 18 in North America? In North America, so a yeshivish or a Hasidish kid might go to yeshiva. A modern Orthodox kid has the option of going for a year, maybe two, sometimes three, to an Israeli yeshiva. Of course, once they've convinced their parents, they're going to get partial credit for those years. In Canada, less so, but certainly in America, if you don't get any credit for your year in Israel, like, you know, a lot of parents will get all upset about that. But the orientation is, well, that's like there's even a term for it. I think the term is so important. It's called a gap year. It's not a real year. It's not like, it's a gap year. It's a transitional. It's a, you know, fills in the gap. But the real life starts, of course, when you go to university, when you go to college, when you start to develop in your secular profession, when you start to gain the skill set will allow you to be productive within non-Jewish society. And again, I'm not being pejorative, I'm just being, you know, laying it straight. In Israel, the normative thing you do when you're 18 is you go to the army. some people in the non-Orthodox, the religious Zionist community go to Hezer Yeshivas, some go to Mechinot Ketam Tzvaiyot, some people do some sort of Shin-Shin, Shnat Sherut. There are all sorts of options as Israel diversifies, but it's clear within the religious Zionist world that the parallel to the university sort of real world is Tzava. And that probably is the one difference that changes everything. It is true, and I'll mention this more later, that more North American kids are doing Tzava. And I think that that's very significant, and I think that's part of the changes that I'm seeing. But nonetheless, that's, today, I mentioned it yesterday, and in my book I write about, I don't think the differences between Haredim and modern Orthodox, between even Haredim and religious Zionists are on a cultural level, on an intellectual level, are the way they once were. But the tzava in Israel is the dividing factor. It's the dividing factor between Israelis and most North American Jews, North American Orthodox Jews. It is the dividing factor between Haredim and religious Zionists in Israel. Because, you know, that is big. And it's not enough to say, oh, they'll go when they get married for 3 months. That's good, significant. The fact that there are professional opportunities in the army and some Haredim are doing these computer programs and there's a lot of funding coming for that now is an interesting phenomenon. But the fact is, in those core years of 18 to 23, 24, that one group is sitting in yeshiva and learning, and the women are usually getting married, or that is their maslul, their path is to prepare themselves for through seminary or through working, but to get married and then support their husbands in kolel. Whereas in the religious Zionist world, the guys are going to the army, the girls are either doing shir ulmi or more and more doing the army. That is a divide which maybe is more important than anything else, and people should just always acknowledge it. Jewish life in a sovereign state and defending that state is so significant in how it changes the trajectory of everything people do. Having said that, what I'm sensing, and this is what I want to write about and explore more in the book that I'm working on, is that there are, that certainly within the modern Orthodox and religious Zionist world, there is more confluence, there are more similarities developing, there are more avenues for a certain type of global collectivity. So here now, I'm going to give you examples where I see confluence, where I see coming together. So look, it started years ago with the year in Israel, where when it became normative within certain modern Orthodox communities for kids to come to Israel, they became exposed. They became exposed to army, to Hezder, to Hebrew. Once upon a time, actually, it was more. This is interesting. When I went to Israel for the year, certainly when I was in Yeshivat Har Etzion, I lived next door to Israelis. I sat at tables with Israelis. I went to an Israeli shir. I had Israeli chavrutot. I had some Americans, some Israelis. I got very friendly with my Israeli, it was a smaller American group. And that's what most of us did. And today it's possible to go to a Hezder yeshiva and do that less. And more of the North American kids, because of the language issue, because of comfort zone issues, are choosing to go to purely American programs. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think those mixed programs, michlala, once upon a time, among the women, Midrashet Lindenbaum has two programs. There's certain overlap. I think in Migdal Oz there's more overlap. We could look at some Shalavim. It's purely an American women's program. I think that these opportunities for engagement are crucial, and I know that the friendships that I created that were created between me and my Israeli friends were very, very important in terms of my aliyah. They were very important in my career development. They were also very important just in terms of my sense of feeling that Israel was a place that I was a part of, and I wasn't purely a foreigner. But beyond that, Army, I said it already. More, there are more North American. I know in SAR High School they had a dinner last year, and they honored all the kids from the graduate from the previous graduating classes who fought in Tsuk Eitan. And it was like 10 kids. I was like, wow, that's really interesting. It was interesting that they chose to focus in on them, but I think that there is a growing group. It's not just children of Israelis. I'm sure in Toronto there are kids who are doing the army. Am I correct? And I think that immersion experience, it's very different than the yeshiva experience. Much harder one, but it's much more of one that leads to a core sense of connection, even if the person ends up moving back to Toronto or to New York or to LA or to Boca afterwards. It changes their whole sense of their relationship with Israel. I think that on a sort of religious trend level, I think there are two things that I've seen that are there are certain overlaps. They are always different, but last week I was invited to a wedding of a yeshivish cousin of mine from Passaic who has 11 children, and this child is neo-Hasidic. He's gone to Uman 3 times for Rosh Hashanah. He met one of my sons there. He's kind of a hipster, but he's Haredi. He had Kalibach music at the chuppah, and all the friends of the families were like classic yeshivish people, and they're sitting at tables, and all his friends are jumping around, not in circles. I don't know if you've ever been to weddings like that. Certainly in Israel, you've been to weddings like that. I don't know if you've seen those in North America, but I think they're with people going to Israel and with people going to Uman and all sorts of stuff. There's a little bit more of this. I'd say it's a little bit of a rebellion of the overwhelming and b'mechilat kvodo. Rabbi Lichtenstein said that the book that he would take on a desert island was Halachic Man. You know, Ish Halacha of Rav Soloveitchik had a tremendous, tremendous influence on North American Jewry. Some of it very positive. I'm not sure if it was all positive, because I think it created a hyper-halachism. I think it created a population in which orthodoxy was defined primarily through allegiance to practice. And Rav Soloveitchik himself, if you read the full spectrum of his writings, if you read Lonely Man of Faith, if you read Uvikashtem Misham, if you read Halachic Mind, you see he was a very spiritual person who was very engaged with relationship to God and with a broad range of aspects of his engagement with religion. But Halachic Man is a very modernist Hegelian book, which starts with the dichotomy between homo religiosus and homo, what does he call it? Ish halacha v'ish hadat, right? And Ish Hadat is those crazy Hasidim who don't really, they're purely transcendental, and the Ish Halacha is the one who brings the transcendental ideas down to this land and walks the walk of the Halacha. And I think that people read that book and sort of became almost, if you're familiar with it, almost Leibovitchian in the sense of focus on the mechanics of the Halacha. I'm not being purely critical, but just I'm emphasizing the critical. I remember my son, Aviad's friend, who's a halachic guy who learns Gemara and is not Hasidic by any means. I remember he told me when he was in Hebrew Law School and he spent a semester at Columbia Law School. So he was living in Riverdale, and he went to one of the shuls and he said, "That is so interesting." He said, "On Friday night, or Shabbos, when they give it to our Torah, now they give something in the parsha. And here in this shul, the rabbi gave a whole discussion about whether you can cut a grapefruit with a special grapefruit knife on Shabbos. And now that's an interesting and important thing, and halacha is halacha. But what he found interesting is that's what the tzibur wanted, or that's what the rabbi felt that the tzibur, that the congregation needed to hear. If you have an opportunity, you have people in shul Friday night, what should you be focusing on? So I think that that's the hyper halachism that maybe, in certain ways, the emphasis on halachic man produced. So it seems to me that Israel is not there. Israel is clearly, if you look at the more popular yeshivas in Israel, and you look at a lot of the focus on spirituality, on certain types of Hasidism, places like Otniel and Siach, or what we talked about yesterday, the move, let's say, if you look from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein to his son, Rav Moshe, from the Rav Lichtenstein's question in Gemara, and I learned from Rav Lichtenstein for 3 years, and I spoke about him yesterday in Or Chaim. Thank you. Rav Lichtenstein always, his only question was how. He wanted to understand the mechanics of the Gemara, how it works, and how this Gemara works against this Gemara, and how you can create multiple possibilities for explaining how multiple sources can exist in parallel. His son Moshe asks why. If you want to see a wonderful article that analyzes this, I have to send it to you. There's an article that it was in the Journal of Modern Jewish Studies that I edited. There's an article by Professor Lawrence Kaplan from McGill University, where what he did was he used the Brisker approach of Rav Lichtenstein as a paradigm, and then he sat in his office in Montreal. You can get it on the internet, and he looked at Shiurim on Masechet Kiddushin, I believe, from Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, from Yeshivat Ma'ale Gilboa, from Yeshivat Otniel, Rav Yaakov Nagen, Ganak, and I think from Siach as well. And he compared the different ways they learned the same sugya. And what he found is that some of them did more, or I know, in one, also Yeshivat Ma'alot, where they have something called Torah Eretz Yisrael. But one was more looking at the Zionistic or Land of Israel aspects of things. One was looking at the more spiritual aspects of things. One was looking at the more analytical, philosophical aspects of things. But what they all had in common, as opposed to the approach that Rav Lichtenstein had championed, was not just how, but why. What is the meaning? And why is that? Because they live in a generation where that's what their students are looking for. They're looking for meaning. They don't just want to know how it works or what is required of them. They need the meaning in order for it to be valuable and to inspire them. So I think that that's something that's very much a trend in Israel. I see certain percolation of that in the United States among people who, some people exposed to Chabad, some people exposed to some of these yeshivas, for a variety of reasons. And I think that's a very interesting event, and it'll be interesting to see. In Yeshiva University, they brought in a Mashkiach Ruchani, Rabbi Weinberg, from the, anyone familiar with that, what's the yeshiva, the shul in Woodmere, Esh Kodesh, which is named after the Rav, Rav Shapira, from, right. So that's a, like a sort of a Hasidish modern Orthodox shul, and the Yeshiva University felt that they needed a Mashkiach Ruchani because there were enough kids in Yeshiva University who related to his sort of Chabakuk. Anyone want to learn Chabakuk? Chabad, Breslov, Rav Kook. Chabakuk. Kalibach Kook. Okay? So the fact that Yeshiva University felt the need for that, I think, is interesting. But here, something that was touched upon, and I think it's big. I sort of mentioned a little bit yesterday. I think that the bridge of feminism is a really interesting one. Historically, the first Orthodox feminists were Americans, Greenberg, other people. If you look at the Israeli scene, the first people who were doing revolutionary things with women's learning were people who came from America, Chaim Bravender, Shlomo Riskin, Malka Bina, Henkin, Chana Henkin, Brian Levy, we could list some others, and still some of them are very prominent. Tamar Ross, but Esti Lichtenstein, sort of, she's already in the next generation, right? Are you familiar with these names? Some of them, okay, Migdal Oz and live in mountains. But their students aren't Americans. Some of them come from American homes, some of them not. Their students are Israelis. The door, the generation of Talmidot Chachamot that are growing up in Israel today are Israeli women. But there's also a great amount of American women or North American women who go to these midrashot and come back to America, and some of them are sitting in this room, or some of them resonate to these things, or are becoming yoatzot halacha, or might be going to Maharat, or might be looking for other venues in which to grow in their avodat Hashem and in their ability to be leaders within modern Orthodox religious life. So it seems to me that there are a bunch of things that are happening that are not erasing, but are sort of creating a less divided religious or Orthodox world between Israel and the United States. Certainly, technical factors, transportation, globalization, the internet, the ability to have, there are people, I know lots of people who have chavrutas. You said you have a chavruta with your Israeli, that's in America.
He's American.
There are people who have chavrutas with their Israeli chavruta from yeshiva. There are people who attend Rabbi Asher Weiss's shir. Or there are people who because of the media, there are all sorts of abilities for people. People who have financial ability may live in multiple places. Even people who don't go as often, transportation is cheaper. People move more. It's not just among modern Orthodox. If you look at Chabad, Chabad is an international organization, and all the Israeli Chabad guys spend a year in 770, and they all know each other, and it's back and forth. But I think also among the more modern Orthodox, the sense that there is a clear. There's North American modern Orthodoxy, there's Israeli religious Zionism, and the factors that I brought at the beginning distinguish between them. That says it, and by the way, the fact that there's more wealth in Israel and that Israel is not as dependent on North American funds also, although they try not to say that when they come to raise funds here, but it's the truth. It doesn't mean that they don't need them, but it's not the same as it once was. It's not as fledgling. I think that there's more fluidity. Now, I just want to make one last point, and then I'd like to hear comments, because we have a little bit of time for that. I'm an academic, and I try to call things as they are, but I'm an engaged academic, and I'm not hiding my personal identity, I'm not hiding my values. And I identify with both of these worlds, the world that I grew up in, the world that I feel very very affectionate towards and appreciative of what I got from people like Rabbi Lichtenstein and from the world of the students of Rav Soloveitchik and from Yeshiva University and from SAR Academy and from the communities that I grew up in. But I'm Israeli, and my wife and I moved to Israel 3 months after we got married. All our kids were born in Israel. We did, some of them were counselors in Moshava and stuff like that, but we're Israeli. And as I said, foreigners in both places a certain way, but if we do want to think, I would say positively or productively about this group that we'll call them, for argument's sake, the synthesis, whether it be the religious Zionist synthesis or the modern Orthodox, Torah, Madav, however you put them. If you want to think of them not as this dying dinosaur breed, but rather something which may be an elite, and it's not going to be the majority in terms of numbers, but a very significant one, which because of its intellectual prowess, because of its wealth, because of its abilities for political power as well, has a very important role to play in Jewish life, I think that we should think more globally. I think that we should think more about a confederacy or a sense, because there are these indications that there is more in common and there is more communication or there's more fluidity between the populations. I think today people don't necessarily. Once upon a time, you moved, and you just moved. Now there are people who might have children who went to Israel for I have students who they don't come to Bar Ilan because they made Aliyah. They come to Bar Ilan because their parents realize it's a really good education and it's much less expensive than American private college, and they'll be in a Jewish environment, and they can even make Aliyah and get funds from the Misrad HaKlita, the Ministry of Absorption. I'm not sure if they're going to move to Israel. I met one of those students yesterday. She's a lovely girl. She's in my class 2 years ago. And, if I were hyper-Zionist, I'd say, oh, that's terrible, you left Israel. I don't think that way. I think it would be nice for her to stay in Israel. I think it's great that she had those 4 or 5 years in Israel. I'm sure if she moves to South Africa or if she moves to Toronto or New York, wherever it'll be, that those years of Israel will be very significant for her. I also think that it'll make her a cultural agent. It makes her a person who's situated in a way where she can, because she's not a shaliach. Shalichim are great, but shalichim are temporary. A person who's part of that world because they've experienced that world, but lives in the other world, they are more of a bridge. And I think that the fact that there are these shared things, the fact that there is more moving back and forth, we have to think, and I don't have the answers, but I'll just give you one example. I don't know how he's going to do. He's a very fine person. Rabbi Ari Berman, who was just appointed to be the new president of Yeshiva University. He's a very fine person. I know him personally. He's smart. He has good values. Whether he'll succeed, it's a hard job. But I thought that the most interesting thing about Rabbi Ari Berman being picked was the fact that he was the rabbi of the Jewish Center in Manhattan. He was a teacher in Yeshiva University. He's very much was a part of the American modern Orthodox establishment, and he's been living for the last almost 10 years in Israel and in Neve Daniel, and his kids went to school there. It was a big thing for him to choose to move back. But I think a person like him is symbolic of the type of bridge that I'm talking about, where it's not an American Zionist in the sense of pro-Zionist who says, I think it's important we have an Israel program. I think it's important that we have, the Gross Kollel. I think it's important that our kids spend a summer in Israel. Those are good things. I'm not saying bad. But a person who lives those two worlds, who is at the head of the most important institution for modern Orthodox Jewish life and cultivation of Jewish leadership, it would seem to me that that may offer an opportunity for a greater sense of a global, I don't want to call it modern orthodoxy, synthetic orthodoxy, integrationist orthodoxy, and I think that to me actually makes me optimistic and seems to be a direction that we should cultivate, and we should be thinking about how to garner that and how to use that productively, and that will make people feel less like we're shrinking. On the contrary, we are expanding, or we are developing in a new way. And I'd be very happy if there are people who want to comment and share their thoughts on this.
Can I just ask how that's relevant now? So you spoke that a lot, the future, we're living in a time where it's changing. But I can tell you personally from, I have Israeli friends, I spent 2 years in Israeli yeshiva, that still, there is a great cultural divide now. So, can I ask what what does that have to do with what we're seeing right now as opposed to the future?
So, I can't predict the future, but I do try to look at indications. So, that's why what I did was in the talk is I said how it once was as people perceived it, the levels of changes that we can also already recognize, and then the question of where it's going to take us, I think there. Sometimes processes just work themselves out on their own. But if we're thinking about where we want to invest our efforts, our time, what types of educational program we want to develop, what types of institutions we want to have, what is our definition of who our community is? Who our community is? I think that these things can't always be lead where you want to go to. But if you think that this might be a good direction, then you have to have people like me thinking about it, and you have people like me talking with leaders or talking with people who are involved in these things, saying, hey, someone like you, you're after 2 years in Israel, you're 20, you're 21 years old, you're in university, you may be a rabbi or you may be somebody in 5 years from now who is thinking about, what are the messages I want to give my community? What are the messages where do I want to focus myself? And that's my privilege. That's what I try to do is to get you thinking about it. Yeah.
So one of the big differences I hear from my children who have made Aliyah, and they're sort of Dati Lumi types, between their life in Israel and their life here is when they're speaking to their less religious or non-observant colleagues in Israel, because their colleagues have to interact with the Rabbanut, it's often a very unhappy interaction and actually drives their non-religious friends to actually hate that. And they don't have that here. So I see that as a very big difference between religious life in Israel and religious life here and how you interact.
So I want to respond to that. Okay. So I think it's a very, very unfortunate thing. I would say, and something that I've combated throughout my career, I was, before Tzohar existed, I was performing weddings, I've performed hundreds of weddings for non-observant couples, because I thought that was a problem, and anything I could do to make it palatable, attractive, to give a good face on Dot was something that I've tried to do. Having said that, it could be that the people who care about religion in America, because they have conservative reform, because there are nice and more user-friendly modern Orthodox rabbis like Rabbi Lichtenstein and people that in this generation as well, then they don't have the same kind of like hostility. But it's such a small percentage of American, certainly United States Jewry, and we know the numbers, and I would even venture to say, and I don't want to be apologetic about Israel because, it pains me, and I try to do my best to neutralize those kind of things, without having expectations I'm going to solve them. Sometimes I think that hostility still means engagement. And in North America, most Jews are just totally apathetic and totally disengaged from anything Jewish, practically, except for maybe Seinfeld or an occasional culinary type of reminiscence. So I want to be clear, and this may sound a little bit overly utopian. I think I moved to Israel not because I thought it was the only place you could be an Orthodox Jew or a good Jew. I moved to Israel because it's a great experiment in Jewish history. It's an experiment. It's an experiment which has a lot of failures, has meant a lot of successes, but I don't expect it to. I think that this is part of the experiment, and it's one that needs to be fixed. We need to find new tools for it. But it's an experiment in Judaism, and in that sense, that gives me hope that as long as people are still in Judaism, which is anyone who's living in Israel, I'm hoping that there'll be better ways to engage them. So again, I don't belittle those comments, and they're hurtful, and when I hear them from people I meet in Miluim or couples that I come to, I've had couples, I'll give you one chance to convince me to do the Rabbanut. And I say, I don't want to convince anybody. If you want to come to me, I'll be happy. I don't do that. But that sort of attitude is bothersome. But yes, and next.
So I'm actually one. This is Israeli. So I was 27 when I left Israel after living there, going to school, university, going to the army. And in the last almost 30 years that I've been living outside Israel, it took us many years to do the undamaged to undamage what Jewish life in Israel did to us. And I know a lot of Israelis here that the word Judaism and Jewish is a word that you shouldn't use. Like if you want to sell them something, you should talk about tradition, maybe heritage. Not even use the word Jewish, not let alone religion, because they're so resentful. So, Israelis who live in Israel are kind of, it's, you know, Judaism has a monopoly, and we go to school and we learn from grade two, I think, we learn Tanakh and obviously Jewish history and Hebrew, obviously, but they do such bad work in terms of instilling in us Jewish pride. Pride in our heritage and the wisdom of Judaism and all the good things, it just doesn't happen.
I wish my Hebrew was as good as your English. Your English is fabulous, really fabulous.
So I hope that people like you bring a different perspective of Judaism to Israel.
I think there's more of it being done. I think there are organizations that are trying. I think it's you know, society is big. Honestly, and maybe I'm missing something, yes, I know those comments, and I've seen them throughout my 30 years almost in Israel, and they're there, and they're sometimes, I was at an alternative wedding and on Chol Moed Sukkot. My wife had a colleague whose daughter got married. They didn't have a rabbi. They had two best friends who came and said, oh, we had all these things prepared because we sat with a couple, but we're so drunk, and then instead of at the end, they said, in a traditional wedding, they break a glass to in memory of the I can't say the word. We're going to drink a l'chaim for the future. You know, it was very much, resonant of those things. You have that. I think sometimes you have, it's not only, but there's a term that's being used very much in Israel now. It's called Medinat Tel Aviv. It's important to recognize that Israel, most of Israel today, there's a reason Netanyahu is in power, because most of Israel is not Medinat Tel Aviv, and it's not what we call Korei Haaretz, people who read Haaretz or go to Abima. Most of Israel today is people who are pretty traditionalist. I think that if I had to put my finger on what is the thing that I find most pessimistic about Israeli society, it's not that people are resentful towards Judaism and religion. I think most people one, at least in a certain portion, they might be annoyed, put off. They don't have a bus to go to the beach, or that once in a while the Rabbanut does something really obnoxious. But I think that it's the materialism. I think that a society that was predicated on socialism and very very quickly developed into like they call it startup nation, but has the standard of living grew so rapidly, and there's so much opportunity for travel, for exits, for living on multiple car families, et cetera, become standard. I think that society has to calm down. I think that's the jump has been really dramatic since the 90s, and I think that is an impediment to spirituality and to religious life. The other thing is there. I'm not sure that I think that's the one. It's just my perception. Yeah.
The question of why, I guess, probably just historically, but why is there no other options in Israel in terms of here you can go. It's not probably got to do with traditional conservative in, that formed it here, which didn't form us like it did in Israel. But here under not necessarily Orthodox, but even from Wayu to Kofay to Hadar to why doesn't this develop there?
So I want to answer your question, but I want to take it a little step further because I think I didn't make this point clearly enough, and I thank you very much for asking. So historically, Israel is it's political Judaism. It's about coalition politics. It's about who is in power. It's about where people are willing to make compromises. The old statement, the synagogue I don't attend is the Orthodox synagogue. A sense even among the most anti-religious that the authentic Judaism is the Beit Saba, is the religion of the religion that I abandoned, the religion, Ben Gurion was not a very observant person, but when he thought about what is religion, if we're going to keep it, he went to Chazon Ish, so there were a lot of political coalition politics involved. America, the reason America is a place of denominations is not because of Jews, it's because of Christians. Because the Protestant, read the first chapter of Jonathan Sarnoff's excellent book, American Judaism. He really explains how denominationalism is specific to the American religious culture and has to do with religion in America is about marketing. And very quickly, in the United States at least, there was a sense that if you want to get people to come to your church, you have to make your church attractive. When you have a monopoly, but that comes a lot from politics. Having said this, and here's the piece that I didn't say enough, I think that there, because Israeli society is becoming more individualistic, the positive side of it is that there's more niches for variety in an unofficial way. And I think here the coalition between American or North American Judaism and Israeli Judaism, North American Orthodox and Israeli Orthodox Judaism, religious Zionist Orthodox is very important. I think if you look to some degree, even an institution like Yeshivat Har Tzion Gush, they were really vilified by the Kuknik religious Zionism for many, many years because they didn't take the party line. Today, they're becoming more and more popular because they have more and more teachers in schools, but also because there's more attraction to variety. There's more of a sense that we don't want to define our religiosity purely on whether we are settlers or not settlers, whether we are in favor of leaving Gaza or against leaving Gaza. There are still plenty of people like that. But even the children of settlers are more, you know, the Hilltop kids. It's sort of anarchic, almost sometimes Hasidic. It's a different world. And I think that there's a lot of grassroots, non-official religious life that's developing in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv. It's never going to be like North America, where it's all privatized, and therefore, you know, membership and all these things, for better or for worse. But nonetheless, there is a lot more of that happening. And I think with, I have a PhD student who wrote this great doctorate about Beit Daniel, Reform Shul in Tel Aviv. It was fascinating to see how they promote religion and who their constituencies are. And in this very secular city, that they're actually making very interesting inroads. Chabad figured that out a long time ago, and other people need to be figuring it out as well. Did you?
Yeah, just a quick question because I'm cognizant of the time. You touched on it a minute in the previous session. Can you comment on the conversion issue that Israel has dealt with, North American conversions and so on?
Just briefly, and will be last comment, and I thank you very, 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 very much for your, you know, your attention and interest, et cetera. And again, people are welcome to stay in touch with me. I think that there are two aspects to it. I think that religious establishment in Israel sometimes has this self-understanding of themselves as like, because we're the future of the Jewish people, we have an obligation. Anything we do is going to decide who's a Jew, you know, what is a Jew. It's something that's began early on, but it continues to be a motif. So when Rabbi Lichtenstein converts Ivanka Trump in KJ, well, you know, Ivanka Trump became Jewish, and that's, you know, that's that. It doesn't seem to have national implications. If Ivanka Trump moves to Israel, well, that is like a precedent, okay? I think that's one piece of it. But we do have to call into mind politics. You know, the conversion discussion is not, as you see now, is not just Orthodox against Reform Conservative. It's Israel, among others, trying to locate itself as the center of Jewish life in the world, and that it can dictate what are the standards of Jewish life in the diaspora. It's also about the politics between the non-Zionist and Zionist groups. Rav Drukman, who's not always such a lenient adjudicator, but on the issue of conversion, he felt that it was, he's a Kuknik, he felt that it was a redemptive issue, and he created this Beit Din that was extremely lenient on conversions regarding at least Russian-speaking Olim. And then along came the Beit Din of Rabbi Sherman, and they disqualified hundreds of conversions of Rav Drukman, who no one would say is conservative reform. So I think that it's a very, it touches on issues that aren't relevant at all to what Jewish life is like here. And those are the topics that I started with, where it's different. As long as conversion is perceived as something that can be used as a power play, it'll be very hard to solve. Once it's viewed as a religious values issue, maybe there'll be more room. Thank you very much, and appreciate you. Thank you very much.